My name is Willie Bolander. I study influence, persuasion, and leadership in selling and sales management, and I teach people how to sell. In this podcast, we'll talk to some of the world's top sales leaders and see what we can learn from them. Welcome to the Sales Lab.
We are here with Christian Hughes. Palmer Holland is the company that you work for. And I mentioned this to you earlier, but I guess I'll bring it up again because it's a good place to start. Your boss told me you're the closest thing to the most interesting man in the world from the Dos Equis commercials. And not to put you on the spot or anything, but why? Why would he say such a thing about you?
I wish he would stop setting me up like that. Number one, I think he knows it makes me squirm and he loves seeing me be uncomfortable. I tend to come at my role a little differently. I did not have the good fortune of going through academia learning how to sell. It was somewhat innate and learned through trial and error over the past 16 years of working at Palmer Holland. So, I mean, I even before this, I already quoted Julius Caesar, and I do that in front of customers frequently. I mean, there's just whatever comes to my mind, there's a pretty good chance it's going to make it out of my mouth, which creates some interesting meetings.
This content is brought to you by the TIE Sales Showdown. That's the Technical, Industrial, and Engineering Student Sales Showdown, hosted right here at Texas A&M University. We have over 200 engineering students taking sales classes every semester and a growing minor program in technical sales. These students are smart enough for STEM and savvy enough for sales, and the TIE Showdown allows them to demonstrate their selling skills in a role play competition where industry partners, like you, serve as judges and provide them coaching feedback. If you're hiring for technical, industrial, or engineering sales roles anytime in the next couple of years, this is an event you can't miss. You can learn more at tx.ag/ties. That's tx.ag/TIES. Hope you can join us.
All right. Well, so let's start with the company first. Can you give us an idea of what we're dealing with at Palmer Holland?
Absolutely. We just turned 100. This motion.
There you go.
It's no small feat for a company in the United States to make it to the century mark. So we are an ESOP. Number one, I think that's one of the more interesting things that we are. We are employee owned. Each of us have stake in the company. And we're a specialty chemical distributor. So we operate in a lot of different industries, but we primarily support lubricants and metalworking. That's one vertical of our company. Plastics and composites. That's the vertical that I'm actually in. We've got coatings and adhesives, and then we have health and nutrition. So we sell specialty additives that go into many different markets. When I say specialty additives, you can think of it like you're baking a cake. You've got flour, sugar, eggs. You have all the basics that go into many different confections, but it's the vanilla that starts to give you a flavor and set you apart. And that's what we represent into formulas of all the different things that I just mentioned. We are the 1-2% of your basic formula that takes it and makes it functionally different than everybody else's on the market. So whether that's flame retardants, UV stability, a lower coefficient of friction, better stability, whatever it might be, that's what we're trying to bring you with the products that we represent from our various different manufacturers.
Interesting. Well, and that's the core doesn't change, but the added features, the added benefits of this kind of 2% is what you guys are doing.
Yeah, the 2% is the most valuable. That's why they leave it in the milk, right? That's a good dad joke. It's interesting how as you work through our roles, you start to realize that so much of chemistry is likely the same. So much of what we do, most of it, the majority of it is the same no matter where you might go. It's the additives that you choose to use and the quantities in which you use them that take your products and set them apart from your competition and also get them across the threshold of doing what they're supposed to do, like flame retardancy. Hugely important to make sure for life safety. And that's where we spend most of our time, in relatively uncommodified markets where you are selling the attributes of something that will take a product and push it into new markets.
Well, you know, the way you're describing this is, I think, very similarly about the world of sales methodology and education and training, that, you know, it's really unlikely that somebody's going to come up with an idea that changes the 90 something percent of the formula. You know, nobody's going to, hey, you know what? I just realized that it's a good idea to talk to customers and identify their pain point. You know, like we have a pretty good core knowledge of this. And yet where the opportunity lies is in these things like, you know, if you phrase it just a little bit different, if you provide this type of an incentive instead of that type of incentive, you know, these very minute looking things that end up making a big difference. So that resonates with me. And so you said you're specifically in the plastics world.
Plastics and composites. Yes, sir. Plastics. So I focus on thermoplastics. That's the most when you think of plastic. And then thermoset composites are carbon fiber, things that are when they come together, they are inextricable. They can no longer be undone. So that level of chemistry just means that it's not going to be generally recyclable, and it can't be turned into itself. So when you take a water bottle, like a PET water bottle, you might have one handy right there. That could be recycled, ground, and turned into something made of PET. A lot of what I do cannot be undone. The chemistry that takes place in the reaction, it creates something new. You might see two-part adhesives on the shelves, like a Home Depot or a Lowe's, like JB Weld is a popular one.
Yeah.
Really great product. When you mix those two things together, it is now something else. It can never go back to what it once was. That's a lot of my day job.
And who are your customers?
Wow, it really is a huge continuum. Major adhesive manufacturers. For me, it's mainly compounders of plastic. Plastic in and of itself has to be compounded, mixed with additives. There's raw resin, and a compounder mixes materials into it and then sells it to someone that wants to make something out of plastic. So if you were going to open up Willy LLC and start making something out of plastic, like a cooler or one of those folding tables that Buffalo Bills fans like to smash in the autumn, you would buy a finished compound and mold it into your shape. The other group of people I call on are called master batchers. These folks make highly concentrated additives in resin that allow you to buy raw resin from large suppliers, generally like in rail cars or truckloads, and then add a little bit of the concentrate. And when you mix it together, you get the same effect. So it's just up to how you want to manufacture in terms of whether you'd use a finished compound or a master batch.
Okay. And then they're doing what with that? They're selling it down the line to somebody else. What happens next?
Anything made of plastic. This is where it all starts. Utterly and truly, in the word plastic, it's right there in the name, right? It's almost infinitely moldable. You know, plastic means pliable, bendable, changeable. You can bend it to your will. I couldn't put an end to where our customers are going. You can spin it into a filament and make a Patagonia fleece. You could make a table. You could make the bumper of a car. Really, the applications, I don't want to say endless. That seems preposterous, but vast.
Virtually endless.
Yeah.
Okay. And your background, how did you find yourself into this role?
The old-fashioned way. Met a guy who knew a guy. I went to the University of Cincinnati. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, originally. And throughout college, I worked full-time at a sporting goods store. And one day, a gentleman came in, and he wanted to get his son something to go fly fishing. And I said, step into my office. This is kind of what I do. And I walked him from the alpha to the omega of what fly fishing is. We spent a couple hours together, and I think I swiped his credit card for an astonishing amount. And when I came in the next morning to open up the shop, he was waiting outside for me. This was not an uncommon occurrence. Generally speaking, guys would spend a ton of money, forget to hide the receipt. Someone at home would find it, and they would have to go return it.
Oh, boy.
So I said, hey, give me a second. I'll turn on the credit card machine. I'll turn on the lights. I'll get the door unlocked, and I'll get you your money back. And he goes, whoa, 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 you misunderstand me. He goes, I want to offer you a job. He goes, my son runs a chemical company out of Cleveland, and our time yesterday, he said, I was transported. The way that you explained something that I didn't understand and made me feel confident that I was buying something of quality, that I was understanding what I was doing. He goes, I didn't care that you swiped my card for X amount because I felt like I got something out of it. I was like, oh, pretty cool. So I gave him my contact information. His son gave me a call the next day. I went up to interview a week later, and that was March of 2009. I accepted the role, and I became the first trainee in our sales program in June of 2009.
Wow.
And been here ever since.
And your background in school was not related to plastics or anything like that, I believe.
It was not. It was communication.
Okay.
Went to
and
the,
so tell me about that transition. So communication, sporting goods, pretty technical role selling plastics and additives.
It was a hard transition. I think one of the hardest transitions that we run into with any of our what we call our CDPs, college development program folks, is that you grow up in academia from kindergarten through college, being given a task, accomplishing the task, cracking your knuckles, the day's over. When you get into sales, you make your own work. And that was a harsh reality for me in terms of having to go hunt constantly. And if you're not busy, it's because you're not creating enough work. I used to love getting a test, a quiz, a paper, because as soon as it was done, that sense of relief. Yeah. In sales, you give yourself the assignments. That was a harsh transition.
And did you have to, I mean, before you even started selling, were you having to like study these products and these materials? Were you kind of doing both at the same time? What actually happened?
Yeah, so the way that we represent our manufacturers, because to be clear, we're a distributor. We don't make anything. We're hired by major chemical manufacturers to be an extension of their sales team. And it might be that their sales team wants to focus on the absolute major OEMs in a certain space, and they need us to open doors at medium size and small accounts. We work very closely with our suppliers. We call them principals. I'm not sure if that's a lexicon that's familiar to anybody else or in any other industry, but our principals work very closely with us and they train us. So the product training starts day one immediately. You're in meetings. We have weekly trainings with all of our suppliers. When they have a new product, they have refresher training. So that started immediately. And the other thing I did concurrently with that is they put me into every part of our company for 1 week. So I was the receptionist for a week. I was in accounting for a week. I did collections for a week. I did every single part of our company's jobs for 1 week over the course of a summer. And I learned a lot of empathy for what I was asking our folks to do. Generally speaking, as a sales organization, everyone is there to support us in the field. And seeing what I was asking them to do day to day to support me, hugely influential to this day of how I handle myself and how I try to approach my job. So that was really interesting for me.
Okay. And is there one selling role in your organization, or are there a couple different forms that salespeople play, like inside, outside, different focuses?
Yeah. So we've got inside sales. Generally speaking, it's accounts that just don't require someone like me to show up. I mean, I will, no shame, but if the geography doesn't work out, if their spend is limited to one product and there's not that much room for growth, we have a really talented inside sales group. We have outside sellers like me. I live in Seattle, Washington. I cover the West Coast. So I'm based out of my home and driving and flying to see people that buy massive amounts of chemicals. We also have people that focus more technically. We have folks that come from technical backgrounds that have PhDs in polymer science. And then we've got folks like me that met the right guy and got a communications degree. So we really run the gamut, but we work very closely together as a sales team. Yesterday, I ran through my phone just quickly. to give this example, I talked to 7 different people on our sales team. And that sort of connection really helps you stay grounded, and it really ignites your passion to go out and do what your buddy did. When I talk to a guy in Florida and he tells me how he sold something, I love taking that story and seeing if it applies with my customers.
Yeah. And so you're talking to people at that level of dispersion. You're talking to somebody as far away in the country as you can get.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As far diagonally as you can travel in the contiguous. Absolutely.
And in a typical opportunity, how many people will actually be involved? You said you talked to 7 yesterday, but I'm guessing those were not all for the same opportunity.
No, it was all different. And I, just before this, I wrapped up a call. It was me and my manager. We had one of our technical support guys on. There were 20 people on the call for one opportunity at one customer with one product. It's incredibly complicated what we do. I have a feeling you're gearing up to ask me that question. What is technical sales?
What is technical sales? Well, yeah, and that's one of the common denominators is, high complexity coming from one source or another. So, what is technical sales?
If you could have been a fly on the wall for that meeting, it would have been the definition. It was multiple vectors of support. We needed several different chemists that specialized in several different branches of chemistry to support this customer. We needed to have commercial support to make sure that the pricing was going to maintain. We had manufacturing. We needed representatives from our manufacturer there to make sure that the plant could support this new product that we were going to create. And we're literally creating a new product for this customer. It's very customized to meet their needs. And it got down to the molecular level. We're talking about, can we do this without this molecule? Because this is causing some degradation at a lower temperature than what we'd typically like to see. For me, technical sales is you're spinning a lot of plates, not just on knowing your product, but knowing your market and knowing your customers' needs and trying to anticipate as much as possible their objections. I know it's a poor definition.
Molecules is not an answer we've gotten to date. So that's that's a new perspective for sure.
Mission accomplished.
But yeah, that sounds pretty complicated. So in your role, you're kind of quarterbacking, managing, some of these relationships. I mean, how do you influence a room of 20 people? Or a virtual room with 20 people.
This one's tough. At a certain point, not having the technical chops, having just learned from experience and doing this a while, you recognize when you're going to have to call in air support, when you absolutely positively need to bring in people that are very much smarter than you to help you solve these. And at that point, your role shifts. My role shifted from I was technical enough to get through the door to start the project. And then very quickly, I need to start calling in my friends and colleagues to help support me. I become more clerical. Quite honestly, right now, I'm scheduling the meetings. We're setting the stages. We're setting the next meetings. There's a little, you use this term, I loved it from a previous podcast, a transference of enthusiasm.
Indeed. Yep.
When you're bending molecules and you are talking about some of the driest topics on earth, offering a little personality to the process can go a long way. Making sure that as in the doldrums as we might be talking about very base chemistry, that there's someone there pushing this forward, kind of emceeing the event, if you will.
Yeah.
So this week I was down in Southern California where I was the technical person for most of it. It didn't exceed what I was able to share. Today was a different story. So every call is quite different.
Well, and that's, I would imagine that takes a little bit of dialing in as well that, some days you get to, puff your chest up and you're the man. And other days you get to go, man, I don't know where we're at. Let me tag somebody in here.
I don't think I'd ever say I'm the man. I'm a large boy at best. But yeah, there were several calls this week where I had plenty of background and plenty of experience in the raw materials in question to hold my own. And granted, we still write a report. Every time I meet with a customer and we talk about a product, the supplier that made that product gets a well-written report about what took place, what my goals were, what we accomplished, and what comes next. So I was able to hold my own, but I still give them a chance to jump back in and say, hey, read the report about this. Did you think about XYZ that you didn't bring up, which happens all the time?
And is that something that you do on your own initiative, or is that like the Palmer Holland way?
It is required of us. I don't know if our competitors do this the same way. Maybe probably not to the degree that we do it, but we operate with full transparency. There's really nothing that we want to hide because we don't make it. Why would I not want the manufacturer who made this product to know every single thing possible, maybe sans price, until we can avoid it? No, we work. The idea is you should feel like you're working with our suppliers. That's the goal, is that when I walk in the door and I bring up Dow Chemical or 3M or whomever, that you feel like you're working with an extension of their sales team. And by and large, I think we do that quite well.
Right on. And you mentioned a moment ago, I forget the exact name of it, but a sales development, sales training type of program. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How does that work?
Yeah. So we've partnered with several schools over the past decade. I think we started with Akron and their Shea Sales Center. Oh, sorry, that was Ohio University, the Shea Sales Center. Now Akron has a sales major, and now we're partnering with you. That is the genesis of our conversation. Yep. So we hire people. You can have a technical background or a non-technical background. It really doesn't matter, as long as we think you can do the job. And you join us for 1 year in Cleveland. You'll be given a small bevy of accounts that range in terms of what they do. And you learn with live ammo. It's not a call center. You don't have to hit a minimum of calls per day. You're learning to call people and extract how we can help them. So you'll be paired off with a vertical. We have a mentor program within that. So everybody gets a mentor outside of the program to call and say, hey, I'm really struggling on this. Can you help me out, or how you do this? And then they travel extensively with us. So this week I had a young guy named Drew who's from Akron, and he's been with us for 2 months, and I think he's already traveled in the field 4 times. So I picked him up in Los Angeles, and we spent a day in Compton, which was awesome, and then worked our way down towards—
They're famous for their plastics.
You bet. And then we moved down to San Diego. So he got to see each call was a different industry. Each call had some crossover in terms of raw materials that we were discussing. And it really is there's no better way to learn than seeing the customer interact.
Yeah.
It was hugely valuable. And again, when you've got somebody in tow with you, you got to up your game. You got to make sure you've got all of your ducks in a row. We spent an hour each night before the calls doing pre-call planning, talking about who we were going to meet with, what I perceived as our strengths, our weaknesses, our opportunities, the threats to our business at each place. So you got to sharpen yourself when you've got the CDPs with you, because you want to make sure that you're putting forth, this is what it looks like day to day. This is what you're doing.
Yep. And that's great. How big of a program is that? How many people do you have go through that in a given year?
Given year, I suspect the max would probably be around 4, one for each vertical, lubricants, engineered materials, coatings, which we call CASE, and health and nutrition. But we're a small, nimble company. We're not responding to anybody but ourselves as an ESOP. So we would never let a good candidate go by. If we would find a way to keep somebody. So I wouldn't say there's a cap. But yeah, it's somewhere 3 to 6, maybe. And I think, I don't know the numbers exactly. We could get that from the people that run the program, but I think we've probably done 20 to 25. And I think our retention rate is close to 90% over the past 10 years.
Meaning 90% of those people are still there to this day.
Yeah. Some wash out. Some, it wasn't their wheelhouse and they wanted to go do something else. Some were really good and got poached, you know, got taken by some go to work for our suppliers. Some go to work for customers. Some go to other parts of the industry, but it's nice to know that we did a good enough job that they were still a valuable asset, that people saw the value in how we train our folk.
What would be maybe a few of the top reasons why a young person should think about a job at a place like Palmer Holland?
I love, well, number one, just sales in general. Everyone should try it. It's the most democratic way of making money. When you do well, you make more. That's a pretty good selling point right there. But if you wanted to work for a company where it's pretty flat, I can call our CEO right now and talk to him openly about anything. It would be a great place to learn an entire industry from a really unique perspective. You know, being a distributor, being the go-between is a really interesting way to see the world unfold. You learn so much. But yeah, if you want to make money, if you want to be independent, and if you wanted to create your own style, we have such freedom in the way that we operate individually. We don't have a rubric. There's no how to perform your job. It is completely and utterly up to the salesperson, the persona, and the tactics that they want to use to get the job done. And at the end of the day, if you're making the customer happy, if our suppliers are happy, and if you're making money, you have a tremendous amount of freedom.
And are there any specific traits, competencies, knowledge, backgrounds, experiences that would be particularly useful in somebody being successful?
If you were a food scientist or a tribological engineer, that's lubricants, a polymer scientist, or you could do coatings and or plastics, that it would absolutely give you an edge in terms of the conversation and knowing a little bit more about how you could help the customer. But a big dose of curiosity smooths over a lot of that lack of technical background. You have to want to understand what's going on. If you can watch the show How It's Made, if you can watch 30 minutes of how a Ticonderoga number 2 pencil gets made and want to know more, it would be a great spot.
That's a rich example. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's one that I watched recently. It's fascinating.
Okay. And what if, I mean, that sounds dispositional, right? That sounds like you have it or you don't have it. Is there a way I can, fake it or force it or?
Yeah. I mean, because we're so well supported by our internal staff, each vertical has their technical experts, that you can lean on if you feel like you've suddenly been outclassed. But we represent manufacturers and they're there every step of the way. So you don't have to know much of anything. You're going to learn it. I mean, against your will, it will happen. Yeah. I think there's a quote by Aeschylus that talks about pain and how, like, eventually it goes away. In your sleep, against your will, it just happens. If you do this long enough, you can't help but learn a lot. But even if you're not interested in chemistry, you don't have to be. If you make the calls, if you get in front of enough people, you're going to find ways to help them.
So curiosity, maybe a polymer science background, asterisk, maybe. Yeah. What else can we bring to the table?
That tenacity where when someone tries to get you off the phone, you can hang in there. When you have a bad call that you're excited to call them back and try and shift the paradigm for their eyes, you know, it takes a little doggedness. It takes some experience. And the first 2 years of my life in the field were pretty dismal. I had a couple of big wins that I was able to hang my hat on. But day to day, I didn't feel like I was a contributing member of our tribe. If you can't chew the leather, should you really be there? And eventually it starts to click. Eventually you've heard these objections before. You've worked around them. You've seen it play out. The time is a big one. Granted, there are people that show up on day one and do a great job. But for me, it took a little longer. But the process was rich. I still lean on those experiences.
Okay. Yeah, this idea of this notion of curiosity being important comes up an awful lot in these conversations and in other conversations. And
I guess at the base, the curiosity is, not only are you curious, but are you willing to use that curiosity to form the next good question? Are you willing to go deeper? Not just are you fascinated by watching a pencil get made, but are you willing to stay there and go, hey, you skimmed over this, but that graphite mix, can you go in deeper? The type of wood? Does the resin content matter? This yellow paint, how open are you to that? Does it have to be FDA because people are chewing on it? I mean, these are questions that, you know, sound silly, but you have to ask them. And it leads you towards different products on our line card that can answer a question.
How often do you find yourself asking a question and then it comes out of your mouth and you're thinking, maybe that is a silly question. Does that ever happen?
Frequently. I mean, shockingly frequently. I'm terrified of what this kid Drew is going to go back to Cleveland and divulge the questions that I asked him from the customers. But it really is. I don't want to say there's no stupid questions, but when you're talking about a silicone gasket that's going into the canopy of an F-22 or an F-35, jet, I gotta know how this works. I have to know the compressive strength, the rebound, the how long does this have to last? At what temperatures are you going to see? Because it's going to sit in the Mojave Desert. It's going to get really hot, and then you're going to fly to what is basically low Earth orbit where it's very cold. How are we addressing this? Those are questions that for the people that work in that industry, they're like rolling their eyes like, ugh, of course it works. Here's how. But I need to know that.
Yeah. Well, and you ask one question that somebody hasn't considered deliberately, and you could save them countless dollars. You could save them an awful lot of time if your curiosity leads you to, because look, sometimes it's often the simplest questions that, it's like when you ask somebody in an elevator, what do you do? Like, well, I don't know, I do like 50 things, and it's supposed to be a simple question, and yet sometimes we just skip them.
It's also the value in how you can ask that question. And one of the things that I always try and promote is that sense of self, finding out what your angle is. And your angle could be different from call to call, customer to customer, product line to product line. But setting yourself apart from the din of the masses. For everyone listening here, that intro musically was created by you, and it's awesome. Yeah, it's true.
That's true. That's true.
But to borrow from that, Metallica, you're familiar. Yeah.
I've heard of them. Yeah.
You've heard of them? All right. Their first album, Kill 'Em All. Seminal moment in their career. Lars Ulrich is playing with standard time. It's not always 4/4. He plays with 7/8. And there's some discordance that at first you might find, what did this guy just ask me? Like, what just came out of this speaker? Like, what am I hearing? But over time, you can appreciate that it stood out from the crowd, that it was different, that someone was willing to take Western canon of music and kind of, needle it a little bit and say, is this, do we have to stay this way from freaking, John Philip Sousa marches to, whatever pop songs we hear today that follow the same sort of rhythm? Are we able to challenge that? So I love being the person that's willing to go a little off script and challenge the way that the customer is thinking about whatever our topic is.
Yeah. There's value. There's value in that. But it is, I think you have to get used to throwing questions out. I mean, shoot, even, you know, college students in a class who are there to, I would think one of their primary responsibilities is to ask lots of questions and learn a lot. And, you know, even in that environment where you're specifically supposed to be doing that, you get a lot that, I don't know, there's something that unnerves people about asking a question for some reason.
If you're, well, I guess the other part of asking questions is you have to be listening. Your questions are going to be based on your ability to listen. If you're asking, I should say there is a stupid question, and that's as they've already answered it, and you're going to ask it again.
Yeah, the one you didn't listen to the answer to. Yeah.
Yeah, but your ability to listen critically to what they're going through, to see the way that people in a room look at each other on a topic, to sense that tension, to say, is there a problem with this raw material that I'm hearing? Or did the testing not go well? Or are you fast tracking this because it worked better than your wildest dreams? You've got to be able to sense that in the room, which is why I so much prefer being in person, because when you're on the telephone, it's a little bit harder. Video conference, it can be a little easier, but when you're in front of someone, it really drops the veil of what they feel about you, what they feel about your company and your products.
Yeah. What you're describing, that ability to sort of detect, and when, once you start getting better at it, I think you can, I mean, it's like so obvious when somebody has something that they want to tell you, but they're not telling you, but it's right there, you know, and I've noticed with students, you have to build that muscle with them as well, that, you know, in a role play scenario or, you know, in an early career interaction, as like a very simple, obvious example, somebody might say, oh, yeah, well, we haven't done it that way since what happened last time. And it's very easy for some people to just gloss over that. But it's like they're almost grabbing you by the collar and say, hey, ask what happened last time, you know? Exactly. And that's a very telescopic one example. But you start to hear things like that, these little offhand remarks, and you go, well, they didn't say that. I think they didn't say that just to fill up the air. I don't think they're getting paid for the word. You know, I think they said that and there's a story behind it. Maybe I dig in a little deeper.
And a lot of times our customers on the other side of the table, they're trained to not divulge. Especially the chemists. I mean, we were in accounts this week that have government contracts making things for aircraft. They are notoriously tight-lipped. And you can ask a question and get a very flat response, but you see a little glimmer in their eye. And I go, what if I rephrased that? And I asked it this way. And they go, oh, well, if you ask it that way, I might be able to share more. So the sense of what's going on in the room, and then the sense of knowing that you've got more bites at the apple. You don't have to try and knock this out of the park. The gentleman that was traveling with me said, man, how did you get to the point where you could ask these questions? I said, it's experience, but I don't know if I'm going over the trench because I'm brave or because I just don't care. I'm going, man. Like, does it really matter at that point? I don't know where it stems from, but I got to know and I got to ask. And it's more fun if you can kind of create that small bit of tension and see where it lands.
Absolutely. I feel with the, with the Julius Caesar quotes and things like this, that maybe you've read a book or two.
I've dabbled. Yeah.
And my question for you is, what are some books that somebody in a technical sales role, they could be about sales, they could be about business, they could be about something completely different. What should somebody, a young professional, have exposed themselves to?
I don't like reading self-help sales related books. I really don't. I find the human experience of just reading what entertains you connects you more. In fact, I had a call on Tuesday where I connected with a chemist based on Pride and Prejudice.
Interesting.
Of all the books that you could read, she was a huge fan. And I don't think that she thought when I walked in that I was going to be able to, you know, spout quotes from Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy. And yet there we were. And it was a really pure, sweet moment between us where we were like, this is great. You know, business be damned. Let's talk about this. And it was a ton of fun. The books that I like reading, in Richest Man in Babylon, that's a killer. I've got that one here. That's one of those. I think my dad gave me that as one of his books because he was in sales. I've always loved that book. Any of the classics, any of the new takes on classics, Song of Achilles was a lovely read that I had earlier this year. I just read a book called Sleep by Honor Jones, which is a really interesting, it's all about relationships. And that's kind of what we're building towards here. Humans communicating with one another. That was a fascinating read. But I would say read whatever you want to read and you'll find people that respond favorably to it. If you make enough sales calls, you want to read Team of Rivals about, you know, Lincoln's cabinet. You'll find somebody out there that wants to talk about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I bought that on a recommendation from someone and then it came in the mail and I saw how thick it was.
Yeah. Is there a movie of this?
I mean, like, whoa. How many rivals are we talking about here? Jeez.
Yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis did a pretty good job on film. I think.
It's covered. It's covered. Yeah.
But I mean, it might be nice to hold a door open in your office.
And I can prop up a monitor or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But it looks cool on the shelf.
Absolutely.
People would say, wow, did you read that thick book? And I can go, absolutely not. I don't have time for that.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, anything that you have, I'm always torn on how to phrase this question because sometimes I ask it and people stare back at me and go, what? And maybe it's just that I'm a professor and it's my job to be critical of everything. Certainly. And curmudgeonly. But, you know, are there things you see out there in the practice of technical sales, opinions you hear, statements you hear, positions that people take that you just think, you know, people are looking at this part of the business wrong?
I mean, yes, there are parts of my industry, parts of our company where I get twitchy when I hear it is what it is. Mm. It's my least favorite thing to hear because everything is what it was until it wasn't. And settling because, this is just the way things work. Why? Why can't we challenge this? That's one of the things that I've heard, you know, senior leaders in various companies say, well, you know, this is just the way it works. I'm like, but you could change that. You're giving yourself in to the flow of the way it's always been done. And everyone that's ever been successful has always challenged that. You know, that's one of the things that I really take exception to. This is how it works. From learning about, you know, again, traveling with one of our CDPs this week, we did a little roundup yesterday at the San Diego airport as we were flying out. And I said, what did you not see this week that you wanted to? And he's like, man, in all my schooling and training, I didn't see you ask for the order. You know, we always learned to ask for the order. And I'm like, well, our sales cycle is over 12 months. You know, you have to sample the product. You got to get all the technical data sheets. You have to have a sponsor. It has to get sampled to their customer and approved. I was like, I said, which one of those customers did you want me to ask for their money? It will not, academia will not always perfectly mimic what we're experiencing in the field.
Sure.
That was an interesting point and a good discussion that we had last night where I said, you'll get to that point. But it's such a small moment in time and so much of the actual sales have happened to get you to that point. That is, it is a small part of it.
Well, and related, I've always sort of scratched my head at the, I'm sure it's incredibly applicable in a lot of situations. It's just not universally applicable. And it's this, make sure you don't want to spend any time with somebody who's not the decision maker. And I'm like, what kind of world are you living in where you know who the decision maker is before you start this process where, oh, and by the way, there's not a decision maker. There's like 20 in the room that are all chiming in and, it's not that simple.
It depends on what you're selling and to whom, because you might be offsetting somebody else's, you might be buying a version of somebody else's stuff. And in that case, you do need a decision maker, because someone eventually is going to pull the cord and say, hey, we're going to move to you. We're going to cut you in on this business. Sure. But for a lot of times when we're dealing in research and development, the decision is going to be made in the results you receive from the chemistry. That's the decision maker. Did you do a better job? Did your product perform admirably? Yeah, you could always say decision maker, but don't skip out on the people that influence the decision maker. There are influencers everywhere, especially if you give them the tools to be on your side. Narrative-based selling, giving them the full story of why it's here, why it's working. Influencers are just as important as the actual decision maker.
Now, you just used a couple of words here that I have to ask you about. Narrative-based selling. Tell us what that means.
So, two-part. If I can teach somebody something. So, my procurement agents, the people that place the POs for me, are generally not the people that formulated the product. But I'll still spend time to explain to my purchasing agents, hey, here's the chemistry you're buying. Because a lot of times they're just buying widgets. Yeah. I want them invested in who we are and what we're doing. So when I explain to someone that might be very far removed technically that, hey, we're working with an ammonium polyphosphate intumescent agent. When you burn it, it chars up like a marshmallow. And that carbon, you've had a marshmallow go too far. You know, like that perfect toasting act that you try and do right over the coals, and it goes from like that perfect tan and gooey to flaming ball. That basic carbon structure of total flaming ball can protect a substrate from flame. That carbon itself protects what's behind it.
Exactly, like in the case of the marshmallow, in fact, yeah.
It's the same. In fact, you could use sugar in some applications as a flame retardant. I'm serious. But taking the time to explain to somebody that's involved in the purchasing of it, hey, did anybody ever tell you how this works at your company? And they go, no, I'm just here to, push the buttons and place the orders. If you can share that time with them, they become an advocate of yours within their own company, even if they're not the one that decides on what they're going to use. And then furthermore, I'm pretty well known in our company for our call reports that we write after the meetings. It's a story. I met with real people. We had a real discussion, and there's always a beginning, a middle, and an end. I don't like the reports that just say, they buy this, I pitched this, we'll let you know how it works out. I met Dale. Dale grew up in Poughkeepsie. Dale went to Southern Illinois University. Whatever it is, I try to build a picture of, here's what I'm doing here. Here's a supplier, why you trust me. Here, bosses. Here's what I'm doing for us. And then what I'm trying to accomplish for the customer and what I'm going to do next. I always try to build the story of what's taking place. So for me, narrative-based selling is trying to flesh out the more holistic view of what's taking place. It's not just dollars and cents. It's not just chemistry. There's a lot of factors at play. And it's a lot nicer to string that together with a story than trying to cram it into Excel.
Yeah. Sure. Well, and when there's any level of complication, I mean, sometimes a narrative will just connect the dots, right? It's not this and this and this and this and this. It's you guys are having a problem with this product, this material not doing well in this environment. And we considered a couple different things, all of a sudden, from the spreadsheet to the storyboard, right?
Exactly. And I think if you were going to ask anybody, well, what's your value prop? If they don't have a story, do they have a value prop? We're cheaper. Lots of people are. that's not always what wins. It can, I guess, but it's not what's going to secure you the business, you know, long term, because the next cheapest guy will win at that point. Like you win on price, you lose on price. Sort of deal. So having a story that entrenches you and makes people think of you more fondly, or if you just helped educate somebody and they think of you more fondly, it's everything to me. That is core sales. It gets back to the base persuasion and rhetoric of it all. It's sophistry. It's storytelling. It's the facts can be inconvenient at times. Tell me a story.
Indeed. Well, I see that we are getting close to the end of our time together. Are there any final thoughts, things that early career salespeople or people thinking about becoming early career salespeople should hear or know or do?
Yeah, this week.
And you can only answer in the form of a narrative.
Once upon a time, ChatGPT. Other AI sources are hugely valuable for you to find an answer. They will also defraud you and lead you so far astray from what you're actually supposed to be doing, and also give you a false sense of security in knowing what's actually going on. We're investing in our own enterprise AI. That's everyone should probably be doing that. We've got a huge repository of information that AI is allowing us to search much more quickly. But if you're using AI to distill what just took place in the meeting and tell it back to you, you're not doing a good job of listening in the meeting.
Hmm.
That's one of the things that I think, especially people coming out of school, need to realize is it can be a really powerful tool. But studies have shown, if you rely on it too greatly, certain parts of your brain start shutting down. You stop learning to ask the question. I give the case of famous scientists did a test with a wild canine, a coyote, and a domesticated dog. They put a treat behind a cage. The coyote went nuts, clawing at it, removing skin, hair, ferociously, never gave up on trying to get this treat. Domesticated dog walked up, slapped the cage once, and then started looking for a person to give it the answer as to what's going on here. You gotta strike a middle ground. No, I don't want you to remove your fur trying to scrape for something, you know, in some sort of Sisyphus type event. But I also don't want you to stop and just look for the answer. You have to find this for yourself. And a lot of the answers are there in the meeting itself.
Yeah. I've been having this struggle in my bag over there. I have four completely full notebooks that I'm carrying around with me like a complete psychopath because I just can't quite get on a digital everything where, you know, and I need to fix it.
My man,
obvious solutions is have a little AI bot, take notes, and then you can search them. Like, but, you know, maybe the answer is both. You know, maybe the answer is, yeah, let it do that so you have a digital record and a transcript or whatever. But then, yeah, you got to, you know, there's just something magical about the, you know, the tactile. I want to scribble. I want to scratch it out. I want to write a little curse word next to it. What are you talking about? Yeah. It's my own inner world on paper.
No one can crack my handwriting. It's hieroglyphics mixed with Navajo wind talking. I can barely read it. So when I'm in like high level meetings, I know that I'm always safe if I'm taking notes because it's generally completely legible.
There you go. Perfect. Well, I appreciate you taking the time with us today. I'm glad we can connect.
I so appreciate you having me.
Learn more about technical sales.
Honored to be here. Excited to start working with you this year too. I hope that some of your candidates get a chance to see who we are and what we do. And I'm always here if anybody wants to reach out and have a very frank discussion about what it's like to work at Palmer Holland in sales.
That's it for this interview. I hope you got something valuable out of it. Of course, if you did, be sure to subscribe and rate this podcast on whatever app you use to listen. Also, share this with your colleagues and friends, and let's continue to have a deeper discussion on all things related to selling and sales leadership. See you next time in the Sales Lab.